Hey, folks, and welcome to this week's podcast. Unfortunately, we are brought together again this week for a memorial. This week, it's the great Bob Moore, who passed away at age 88. He was on the show back in 2007, so this one goes quite a ways back. He is, I think, without question, the greatest country music bass player of all time, and I can't imagine anyone else will ever challenge him for that title, just because the way things have changed so much in the world. He comes from a time when a small group of guys, a handful of guys, worked day and night and recorded the bulk of every song that was on the country charts for a few decades. He did 17,000 sessions, and if a session is, you know, somewhere between one and six songs, do the math times 17,000, and that's how many songs he's on. You know, he was just part of this A-team. And he would play every style in the book, including some huge pop hit sessions. So I am going to read you a little bit of a list just so you know what we're talking about here. Elvis Presley, Bob Dylan, Marty Robbins, Roger Miller, Bobby Helms, Brenda Lee, Jerry Lee Lewis, Flatten Scruggs, Andy Williams, Wayne Newton, Patsy Cline, Burl Ives, Webb Pierce, Farron Young, Tammy Wynette, Conway Twitty, Willie Nelson, Dolly Parton, Kenny Rogers, Dottie West, George Jones, Ray Price, Reba McEntire, John Denver, the Statler Brothers, Bobby Goldsboro, Paul Anka, Debbie Boone, Tom McLean, Tom Jones, Hank Williams Jr. The list is on and on. 17,000 sessions. Truly amazing. And he was a solo artist. We're hearing some of his instrumental solo stuff behind us right now. So his achievements are really kind of mind-blowing. Just an incredible, you know, you cannot listen to any mixture of classic country and not hear Bob Moore on the bass. Enjoy. I think this is pretty good. You know, he was a little worried because his memory, he was worried about his memory, but I think he does a great job here, and we get a great peek into a world gone by. We will miss Bob Moore. All right, Bob Moore, welcome to WFMU. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm fantastic. You're still down in Nashville, is that right?
Well, I'm in Franklin. That's part of Nashville.
And tell me, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Nashville on the east side, about 16 blocks away from downtown.
And when did you start playing the bass?
When I was about 12 or 13, I had a couple of two brothers that were friends of mine, and they're mother and father bought them guitars for Christmas, and so I'd hang around over there, and we'd play the guitars and sing and learn and whatever we could. And then when we got in the band at junior high school, I noticed that there was a bass sitting in the corner that never got used, and so I asked the band director there if I could take it home and practice. He said, well, if nobody uses it, I don't see any problem with that. So we got to taking it home, and I got to playing. Never looked back.
Do you think it's something that just came natural to you, the bass?
Well, kind of, yeah. When I was 9 or 10 years old, I built me a little portable shoeshine stand, and I'd go downtown and by the Ryman Auditorium on weekends and shine shoes. At that time, Fort Campbell here was the place where all the paratroopers, where they'd depart from military.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, they'd come into Nashville, and I had my little shoeshine place, and I was making my money that way, and shining paratrooper boots. And so I was right by the Grand Ole Opry, and everybody down there got to know me, and next thing you know, I was backstage, and growing up some, and the two brothers and I had run into another guy who was a fiddle player, and we formed a band called the Eagle Rangers, and we booked out around town in high school gyms or someplace like that and put on little shows, and we made some money. We did pretty good, and our names got around then, and my name got around especially as being a pretty good musician. And so I was offered a job, and I went on the road first with on a tent show with Jam Up and Honey and for a couple of years, and then I left them and went with a real good a band called Paul Howard that had some really good musicians on it, and they some of it rubbed off on me, and I got to playing better and better. Then I left them and went with Jimmy Dickens, stayed with him a couple of years.
And you're still about 15 or 16 years old at this time, right?
Well, yeah. When I was with Jimmy Dickens, I was 18. And then I got hired for the big show then. Red Foley called me, and he was the biggest thing in the country at that time going on. And I worked with Red for a couple of years, and then we went to Springfield, Missouri, and did Ozark Jubilee from there. And here I was going back and forth every week from Nashville to Springfield. And I was working in Nashville with Marty Robbins and in Springfield with Red Foley. And after the Ozark Jubilee shut down, I didn't have to go back up there, and I was well acquainted with Owen Bradley by then, and Owen is the guy that built the first studio here in town, and from then on it was all records, and I worked records for in the studios for 60 years.
Is that all? That would be starting right around the very early 1950s, and there was a real boom in country music right then. What do you think happened?
Well, they had me there.
Of course, right. I think a lot of people don't understand exactly what the bass guitar does. I think some people don't even realize it's on a record or it's in a band. They just think it's a guy with another guitar. Did you have clear role models, or was your style something that you had to develop yourself?
Well, all of the above, yeah. As you go, you know, you hear other people. I started getting calls to come to New York, and I went up there and did a whole bunch of work several times. I'd go up and stay a week in New York and just work the whole time I was there. I'd be in the studio.
And what kind of sessions were you cutting in New York?
Oh, we was doing people like Demita Joe and, let's see, and Brooke Benton and Bobby Goldsboro was up there. There's not any way now to have an absolute accurate account, but from what we have been able to find out and know how many, I did a little over 17,000 record sessions.
Yeah, that is really an amazing thing. On your website, there's a couple of copies of pages from, I guess it's your diary or a logbook, where you kind of keep your appointments, and you can see a sort of a typical week, how many sessions you played on, and how many hit records in one week you would cut these amazing sessions. Tell me about during your busiest time in Nashville. What was your typical day like?
I'll give you an example of, let's see, I've got a book here. Elvis Presley. We started with Elvis on a Sunday night. He liked to work all night, and so we'd record with him all night on Sunday night. And then Monday, I had three other sessions with Marty Robbins, and Monday night back with Elvis all night again. And so I didn't get any sleep all that week. I worked 18 sessions that week.
Wow.
And with them and with, you know, other people too.
It sort of seems like the Elvis idea of a long session going all night is sort of the exception to the rule, that most of the time it was, a three-hour session?
Yeah.
And you would cut three songs during that time?
Well, sometimes we would get six songs in a session sometimes, but that's what the Musicians Union allowed, was as many as six if you could get that many. Simon and Garfunkel, for instance, when we were working with them, they spent 13 three-hour periods, which is 13 record sessions, doing one song. They just wasn't happy with what they were doing, and we'd do it over and over, and then change keys and change arrangements, and they finally got what they wanted, It took a long time, but they sold some records. They sold a lot of them.
Yeah, you play on Bridge Over Troubled Waters. I mean, you played on some giant, giant cuts by them. What did the Nashville guys, who are used to working with country artists mostly, what did they think of these two guys from Brooklyn?
Well, we've worked with most, you know, we work with everybody in every kind of music. We had a big band here, a big a dance band that was second to none, and we'd work that, and we'd go in the studio and we'd do bluegrass music. After that session, we might go do somebody like Jim Reeves or Patsy Cline, and they were country, but they were in the country feel, but I don't necessarily think that they are country records, you know.
They're, yeah, very pop records.
Well, kind of like that. We worked with Perry Como and people like him that were considered big pop singers, but they sang and we played, you know, just the same as we would with anybody else.
If you had a three-hour session with somebody like, you know, Tammy Wynette or Loretta Lynn or Johnny Horton, any of these folks, that many folks that you played with, would you be recording songs that you generally didn't hear until you walked in the door? And would you listen to a demo, or would you listen to someone singing, or would there just be a lead sheet there and you just sit down and work it up?
Well, we'd sit down and work it out. Usually we had the answer is that normally we had not ever heard the song. Sometimes somebody would come in and cover a song. Like, for instance, Wolverton Mountain. I think I played personally on 31 Wolverton Mountains.
Wow, so you could just play it in your sleep. By that.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's an incredible consistency to the guys like yourself who play on these records. I mean, Grady Martin and Hank Garland, the same guys show up over and over and over again. Was it a lot of fun working with those guys? Were they like your brothers?
Yeah, it was exactly that way. We all played off of each other's playing, and it became such easier and easier and more enjoyable. A lot of people, I feel sorry. I see a lot of people going to work sometimes and they got a tired look and they're going into driving their cars, and I always drive to work. I had a smile on my face because getting to go and play good music and be with your friends all day, it's been a tremendous life.
Yeah, well, that's nice to hear. You're right. Most people don't enjoy their job quite that much. We're talking about some incredible records that that survive to this day. Of course, the Elvis Presley records and Roger Miller records, Patsy Cline records, Bobby Bear, Marty Robbins, Roy Orbison. I mean, it's just everybody. Bobby Helms, Jingle Bell Rock. It's Almost Christmas Time. That, you know, Brenda Lee records. It goes on and on. You must hear yourself on the radio every day.
Yeah, that's the good thing about it is at my age now, when I'm driving someplace, I have the radio on. I hear me every day.
And do these sessions all blend into one? 17,000's a lot of sessions. Or when you hear that, do you sort of remember, oh, I was drinking a Coke and, you know, that was a cold day? Or
when you're in the studio, there's no windows. And if you're in there all day long, well, you just in the studio. And so you don't notice what goes on outside, and so you don't, maybe if there's a giant snowstorm or something, you might remember that. I remember times like when Burl Ives was cutting one time, and we did a Holly Jolly Christmas, and we was laughing about it, him and I, as we walked out the door. There's about 2 feet of snow out there, and he said, boy, I said, we cut that at the right time.
You co-founded Monument Records in 1959 with Fred Foster, and of course, Monument had huge success with Roy Orbison, among others. Tell me about working with Roy Orbison and cutting those records. They're just, you know, really exciting records to listen to. Were they exciting to cut?
Yeah. Yeah, Roy was very easy to work with. Roy was a very quiet guy. Straight up, sober, quiet. Kind of stand off and let us make up the arrangement, and then when he'd break loose and sing, I think he's probably one of the finest singers that's ever lived.
Yeah.
There was nothing that he did that was not really good and really different and very recognizable.
You started to make your own records under your own name, and in 61, you had a big hit with the song Mexico, reached number 3 on the charts. What made you decide to sort of step out and try to do your own thing?
Oh, I just had an idea and went in and put it down. I talked to some people about my idea, and Boodle O'Brien was a big songwriter at that time, and Boodle O wrote the song. He wrote the melody, and I'm, of course, being part owner of the record label, I had no trouble putting it on the record label. And so we went to the studio and cut it, and it really surprised me. When it came out, it went right to the top.
Yeah, I think it was number 3 on the Billboard charts. That's a big, big hit.
Yeah. Yeah. It was real big in Germany. It was number 1 in Germany for a long time.
And did you have to decide at that point whether or not to sort of put a band together and go on the road or stay home and cut sessions?
Well, I wanted to stay home. I didn't want to get into that part of it. I was doing as well as you could do. I was working constantly, and so I wouldn't quit that. I know when Elvis went to Las Vegas and started up out there, the job was going to be for 13 weeks. That was their original contract. That was what I was told, and they asked me to go out there, and I said, I can't do that. And so that's Elvis went and hired a new band. Nobody could go because all of us was doing all the work here in Nashville, and to go away for 13 weeks, you'd come back, you wouldn't have any work.
Right. Tell me about some of the sessions that are your favorite, some of the folks you love to work with, some of the records that you still love to hear now.
Oh, well, George Jones, of course. I always enjoyed that. I produced some of his records. Johnny Cash, Waylon Jennings, Willie Nelson, Burl Ives. Was very enjoyable to work with Burl Ives session. I could just go on and on and on. But, you know, Jim Reeves, he was a really nice guy. And
when you were cutting records with these folks, did you know when you had a hit? Did everyone know, or was it sort of a mystery until it came out?
Well, again, it's both ways. Sometimes you really feel like that you've just cut a hit, and then other times you don't know. You know, you cut something in the back side of the what they call the B side of the record, it would hit, and you'd be surprised that the other song on the other side didn't be the hit.
Tell me about Brenda Lee. She was so young and such a powerful performer. What was it like cutting sessions with her?
She was 9 years old when I first met her. She was when I was going to Springfield, Missouri, and doing that show up there. And she would come and do sing, you know, a little girl singing on that show. When I came back to Nashville from up there, and about the same time she came to Nashville and made a big hit. She's still at it, you know. She goes out and does things every month.
Yeah, I had her on the show here, and she's still got a lot of energy and, you know, still happy to be making music, which is great. Towards the 1970s, I suppose, right around then, people stopped cutting records live, you know, where the band would just cut a record in real time, and that was sort of the end of that studio system with that, you know.
You're talking about the age of electronics.
Mm.
Yeah, well, yeah, it didn't come overnight. It when they first started, they went to when I was first in the business, we cut records straight to disc. There was no tape involved. And then when the tape machines came in, that allowed them to have more tracks, and they could put each instrument on a different track on the one tape. And so if the singer wasn't there, it didn't make any difference. We could go ahead and cut the song and put the band down, and then the singer could come in later. Nowadays they have Pro Tools, they call it, and they can change keys. They can do anything and do it all electronically.
Right, they can fix a singer who's singing flat, or
that's right. Yeah,
and Do you think that's changing the way musicians are playing, since they don't have to worry about that?
Yeah, I actually do think that if you're in the studio and everybody is there playing together at the same time, somehow or another, that sound is different, and it goes through the wire. And it's just, I don't know it. I really don't know what you call it.
Yeah, it's magic. tell me about working with Jerry Lee Lewis and what he was like.
Oh, he's just like what you see him on the stage. That's all. When you see him, you've seen him.
Wow. He's just like that off the stage. That's kind of intense. do you think that the Sidemen have gotten their due?
Well, they're beginning to now. It's been a long, long time. They were not even put on the labels of the albums until 10, 12, 15 years ago. But before that, the musicians were never mentioned. Over the years, now they're now actually people like you have helped it along because you recognize now when you look at an album cover, you recognize some of the people that are on it, and that's worked out good for us. So I'm doing things now at the Hall of Fame, and they have some kind of little presentation thing going on all the time, and there's the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I went up to Cleveland and did an interview thing on the stage up there, and then there's the Country Music Hall of Fame. It's here in Nashville. That's probably the biggest, and then there's a new one started up that is the Musicians Hall of Fame here in Nashville.
So are you still playing?
Oh yeah. Yeah, I played. I did an album this last week with Scotty Moore, who was Elvis's guitar player, and I did a Ray Price album here not long ago, and a Willie Nelson thing not long ago. Yeah, and we just finished a really good album with Billy Swan. Billy Swan had a big hit on I Can Help.
Right.
So I'm still playing. I'm not doing four sessions a day like I used to. But I keep my hand in. That's what I do.
Bob Moore, it has been a pleasure to talk to you and sort of get a peek behind the scenes of someone who's played at 17,000 sessions. That's an amazing accomplishment. Congratulations.
Well, my telephone is still ringing, and I'm glad of that.
Yeah.
Been a blessed man, and I appreciate everything that that I've done, the opportunities that I've had. I really am thankful for.
Well, thank you for taking a minute of your time out and talking with us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed it.
All right, Bob, I appreciate it. Have a great weekend and a great holiday next week. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Sure, bye-bye.